Hi there, everybody, and good morning. This is Bio 241, and it is September 12th. It's a Thursday. We're going to finish up Chapter 6 today. Here's the sign-in sheet. I'm going to pass it around now, but if you're going to leave early, please don't sign the sign-in sheet. Only sign the sign-in sheet if you're going to be here the whole class period. All right, so I've got the schedule. Let's take a look at the schedule that's on the right-hand side. And I think I want to leave the lights up for a moment, unless you can't see. Can everybody sort of see the slides? Eventually, when I get to the slides 100%, I'll turn some of the lights down. Okay, so today's the 12th. No test today. We've got 1 week next week, the 17th and 19th. I'm going to talk about Chapter 3, and that's going to finish up material for the first test, which is on Tuesday, okay, which is about a week and a half away. All right, so your first exam is on September 24th. It's going to cover chapters 1, 2, 3, and 6. And in the study guide, it tells you what page numbers in those chapters. All right, study guide tells you what figures I'd like in those chapters. So that study guide is really a nice key of what you have to study and prepare for the lecture exams. All right, so if you practice the pre-lecture reading assignments, if you look at the end of chapter questions, if you look at all those online practice questions in Blackboard, and you look and you memorize those exam figures, you'll probably have a pretty good time on the test. All right, so those are the things that you need to do to prepare. Any questions about that test coming up in about a week and a half? Okay, we'll get started same time. And I don't know how long we can go. We can go until when the next class starts in here, and I don't know when that is, right? So you might have a couple extra minutes. Is somebody?
We end at
12:30. Oh, okay. Well, today. Yeah, you know, I'm so confused on that, so you certainly could confuse me even more, because when we went to that short semester a couple semesters ago, none of those numbers are even and easy to remember anymore. Okay, but I'll give you as much time as possible on that exam. So what do you need on that exam? Well, you need a pencil. You need an eraser, like one of the ones that are in the syllabus. Don't bring in a cheap eraser. Get one of the white plastic ones. They seem to work the best in erasing. The bookstore doesn't really have good erasers. They sell a Paper Mate, which is a smudger kind of eraser. That's not really good. You don't want to smudge up your Scantron. So get one of the ones that are in your syllabus. So you need a good eraser, and you know it's good, go to a clean piece of paper, make a mark with your pencil, and then erase it, and if it smudges, then just throw that eraser away so you're never tempted to bring it to an exam, okay, especially a board exam, because that could cost you $500. Okay, then you need a picture ID. Don't forget that picture ID, picture ID, and then an 882 Scantron. It's just a one half page, but you can bubble in both sides. Okay, and I think, oh, yeah, you also need a calculator, a basic scientific non-graphing calculator. And if you have that kind of calculator in your phone, guess what? You can't use it. It has to be a standalone calculator. And since I mentioned phone, I'm going to turn my phone off, because we got to keep all our phones off when we're taking a test. So this is not like an online quiz. It's closed notes, closed books, and individual effort on a lecture exam in here. Okay, any questions on the schedule or how you need to prepare for the exam coming up on the 24th of September? Okay, I think you guys are all doing good. All right, so I'm going to start talking about some of these slides, especially with regard to last lecture. Here's a really important slide. Okay, and there's one molecule that really jumps out at you. Hopefully it has a certain kind of color to it, maybe, so that it stands out compared to the background and other kinds of things. And it's a very important molecule, probably one of the most important in your body. And can anybody see which one I'm talking about? Okay, sodium and potassium, very important, but there's one that's even more important. Okay, but it's on this slide. And that is ATP. Okay, and ATP is a molecule. I didn't draw it out for you. I'm sure your book has a picture of it someplace. And it's the energy molecule in your body. If you have ATP, different systems in your body can do work, right, because of that energy. So If ATP is not present, your body can't do any work. And this slide right here shows you what probably the most important work your body does. Right? And what does this slide show you? What is it? What are we looking at right here? The sodium potassium pump, right? And is a pump an active transport mechanism or passive? And active, and since you see this ATP, you could also tell me what kind of active transport. It's primary active transport. Okay, and I think when we were talking about this pump right here, I said most of the energy in your body is used up just to drive this pump right here, just to make this pump work in your body, much more so than muscle contraction or breathing or pumping of your heart, all right, but just this little pump and all these cells that you have in your body. Okay, so I don't know if you realize how important ATP is, but I want to give you a couple ways to think about ATP and how important it is. Since it's energy molecule, your body can produce it as long as you have good oxygen being supplied to cells. That's a very nice, easy, efficient way of making ATP if oxygen is present. Okay, and if we cut oxygen off to a particular organ, then it can't make ATP through efficient ways. It can only make a little dribble of ATP, which for some organs is not enough to keep it alive if it's a very metabolic organ. And one of those organs is your brain, of course, because it's working all the time. Another one that's highly metabolic is your heart, because it's pumping all the time. And a third one would be your kidneys, because they're working all the time as well. All right, so let's consider, right, if we remove ATP, or if we remove oxygen to your brain, it's going to run low on ATP, and you won't be able to maintain consciousness. So when blood flow to your brain is cut off, how long can your brain stay active? How long can you remain conscious when that happens? Okay, and probably some of you kind of know a ballpark figure because you've taken CPR, and generally it's about between 2 and 3 seconds. Not very long. I don't. Maybe somebody had another example back there. Maybe you were thinking of a couple minutes or an hour, maybe 12 hours or something like that, but it's just seconds. Okay, so when somebody's heart stops, blood stops flowing to the brain, no oxygen is going to the brain, and the brain uses up that ATP, can't be regenerated, and you have about 2 or 3 seconds of consciousness. Your brain isn't dead just yet, okay, because there's some other processes that are making a little bit of ATP, but not nearly enough to keep your brain alive for a long period of time. All right, so that's the second question I have. If you become unconscious after about 3 seconds because you're not making ATP, how long do you have before that brain really dies? Because there's not enough ATP in there to keep it alive. Okay, so, and remember, that's what we call death. Death is irreversible. So where do we get to that point where we can't ever revive that person's brain? What period of time? Okay, 2 to 3 seconds, you lose consciousness. 2 to 3 minutes, then the brain dies. So again, a really short period of time. So during that time, you got to start doing CPR on somebody to deliver a little bit of oxygen. And does anybody know how you would deliver some blood to somebody's brain when they're unconscious and their heart isn't working? With chest compressions, right? That pressurizes the heart and that pumps a little bit of blood to the brain so the brain can make some ATP to stay alive under those conditions. Not enough to wake up to become conscious again. Okay, so the person is going to look like they're dead, but still keep doing those chest compressions because maybe you're keeping their brain alive enough until somebody can start their heart up again in the hospital or on the way to the hospital. Okay, so that's how important ATP is, and you use it up very rapidly. So another way to think about ATP is how much do you need every day for a 24-hour period? And we could just think of it in terms of weight. How much weight of ATP do you need? Okay, how much weight is burned up in your body just to basically run this pump right here? This is the most energy-consuming mechanism in your body, right? So let's consider what an average weight of a person is. A textbook weight of a person is 70 kilograms. We don't really think in kilograms, but let's just use kilograms because that's what's published in textbooks. All right, how much ATP do you need if your body is 70 kilograms? You need 40 kilograms of ATP, more than half your body weight every day just to stay alive. All right, so that's a huge number. Of course, you don't have to carry around 40 kilograms of ATP in a suitcase, right? Even though you need it every day, but your body can regenerate it. So you use 40 kilograms in order to make to maintain homeostasis. How much ATP does your body have to make? If you use up 40 kilograms, your body has to make 40 kilograms. That's exactly the same amount. And that's done by primarily mitochondria. So that's a huge amount of ATP, and it's mostly used to drive this pump right here. Yeah, question.
So can you, exercise and diet, produce more and store ATP?
We can store some molecules, but not ATP. Usually we can store glucose in the form of starch. We can store lipids in the form of triglycerides as fat. There is sort of a storage form of ATP. It's called phosphocreatine. And when ATP is broken down, if you have phosphocreatine, the phosphate on phosphocreatine can jump over to ADP and make ATP quickly. But we don't have a lot of that in our body. Muscles do. Our brain, I think, does. Our heart does. Kidneys don't, liver doesn't. So sometimes we have a little bit of a reserve in the form of phosphocreatine. Yeah.
The supplement, like the creatine supplement,
yeah.
Would that help?
Yeah, I think that's the theory behind taking creatine supplements, but you got to be careful with that because creatine and creatinine have a tendency to destroy kidneys. They plug up kidneys, and that's definitely a problem. Okay, yeah. All right, so what else is nifty about this pump right here? Just besides you see ATP, so you know it is primary active transport. The other thing that you should realize is, of course, that there's sodium and potassium being transported, but are they being transported in equal numbers? No. How many potassium are transported and how many sodiums are transported for every ATP?
Three
sodiums out. And only two potassiums in. All right, so if three sodiums move out, it's going to take three positive charges out of the membrane. And for potassium, it's going to bring two positive charges in. Is that going to maintain electrical neutrality across the cell? It won't. So what happens to the inside of the cell when this pump is working? Does it stay the same electrically? Does it become positive or does it become negative? Okay, well, only two positives enter, but three positives leave. So if more positive leaves than enters, it becomes negative on the inside of the cell. So we call this cell an electrogenic pump, right? It helps develop the membrane potential across this membrane. All right, so that's really all I wanted to recapitulate or talk about on this slide once again, and also give you a feeling how important ATP is, right? Do you think ATP is an important compound? Yeah, right, because your brain needs it, and your brain can only function for a couple seconds if it can't make it, if it can't regenerate that ATP. All right, so I want to go to, next slide, next couple slides. Another important slide is this one right here. It's kind of a synopsis of what we looked at last time. Because I see passive transport taking place across the cell membrane, I see active transport, I see primary active transport, as well as secondary active transport. So you should be able to label all of these different things, okay, according to what kind of transport mechanisms are taking place. The easiest one, and it's even labeled on the slide, but pretend the label isn't there. What kind of transport is this right here? Is it passive or active? It's active, and what kind of active? Primary, because there's an ATP, right? And that's being broken down into ADP. And here's that electrogenic pump. And that's what uses up most of the ATP in your body to maintain the health of these cells. Here is glucose going from high concentration to low concentration. Is that active or passive? High to low is passive. High to low is always passive. Low to high is active, like your car. If it goes from at the bottom of a hill to the top of a hill, it just won't automatically roll uphill. It needs energy, right, in the form of gasoline, for instance. All right, so going from high to low is passive. This is a special kind of diffusion. Remember, diffusion is passive because glucose can't get across this nonpolar region in the plasma membrane. Glucose is very polar molecule, so it can't get through the cell membrane. It can only get through if there is a special channel that allows glucose to get through, even by diffusion. Okay, then let's look at this one here. We have glucose going from low concentration to high through this membrane protein. Low to high, is that active or passive? That's, it's got to be active transport, right? Taking your car from low to high requires energy. So here is active transport. Do you see any ATP here? No ATP. So it's not primary active transport. So by process of elimination, you would call that secondary active transport. But you should also know why it is secondary active transport, because, okay, there's no ATP, but there's another energy source. And I see the energy source, and you should be aware of it. And that is sodium. It's at high concentration outside the cell, just like it should be for a living cell, and it's low on the inside. That's the gradient of sodium. And there is energy in any kind of gradient, because what does this gradient really like to do? It likes to equalize sodium, right? There should be an equilibrium where sodium is the same concentration on either side of the membrane, and this is not that condition. Right, so sodium wants to diffuse inside the cell, and when it does, right, it releases some energy, and that energy is enough to take glucose from a low concentration to a high concentration. So it's not directly using ATP, it's using ATP indirectly, so we call this secondary active transport. And then you should know what kind, there are a couple different secondary active transport. There's co-transport, antiport, and you should know which one this is as well. And it's labeled on this slide. So here is a pretty important exam figure, but I think to make really good sense, you should go back and review your kidney anatomy, especially of the nephron, so that you can kind of see what's happening right here. All right. Okay, so that's an important figure. And that kind of brought us to membrane potential. And okay, and remember, potential just is another fancy word for voltage, which means that there is some difference in electrical charge from one location to another, and in us, that those two different locations are usually separated by a membrane. Right, so when you have something separated like that, we can consider that a battery. So let's look at the membrane potential, one reason why it develops. We talked about one reason why it develops already. And that is because the sodium potassium ATP pump is what? What was that one word I used? It is electrogenic, right? Meaning that it doesn't transport an equal number of potassium and sodium, and they have an electrical charge, right? So every time this pump works, the inside of the cell gets a little negative, right? Every time this pump works, because three positives leave, but only one positive ion, I mean two positives come in. Three leave and two come in. So the inside of the cell gets a little negative. But there are other reasons why as well. So let's talk about the fundamental reason why there is a membrane potential. And it develops very easily. It develops passively. That the sodium ATP pump is active. This is just a passive mechanism. All right, so let's draw a cell right here. And it's going to be permeable to potassium. So here is potassium at a high concentration. How much potassium is inside that cell? How much potassium is in there? How much potassium? How much potassium do you see inside that cell? I don't see any potassium in there, right? Okay. And I see a lot of potassium outside the cell. And let's just say this membrane is permeable. Will potassium want to go from outside the cell to inside the cell? Yeah, right? Just by passive diffusion, because it can get through the membrane. No energy is required. And if we wait a long enough period of time, how much potassium is going to be inside the cell? Exactly the same amount as what's outside. And when the concentration is same, the concentration gradient is zero, what happens to diffusion? Stops. Okay, so let's just draw in, okay, four potassiums inside the cell. So what is making potassium initially move across the cell membrane? What's the process called? That is diffusion. Okay, diffusion. Yeah, not quite osmosis. Maybe you should see me. We'll talk about osmosis a little bit. Okay. Okay, so diffusion for sure. And diffusion is when there is a concentration gradient. When the gradient goes away, diffusion stops. Right? So that's a nice equilibrium. Nothing is changing. But that's not how a cell really is, because a cell has proteins in there, right? And proteins have an electrical charge on them. These proteins are so big, they can't get out of the cell. Even though there's a gradient in proteins, Right, there's high protein here, low protein here. It can't diffuse out of the cell. It's stuck inside the cell because it's too big. And it has a negative charge, right? And what can you tell me about opposite charges? They attract each other. All right, so we had an initial equilibrium where there's the same concentration of potassium in and outside the cell. Then we put all this negative charge inside there. Is that going to disrupt the equilibrium? Because positive and negative do what? They attract each other. So these negatively charged proteins, right, will they kick some of the potassium out, or will they kind of get some more potassium to go in the cell? It's going to draw more potassium inside the cell. Okay. So under those circumstances, right, then we're not going to have an equal concentration of potassium on the inside and the outside of the cell. You're going to begin to have more potassium. Right, because these proteins are drawing it in. So there are two effects right here. The first effect for bringing potassium inside the cell is concentration. Concentration gradient, which is diffusion, that's number one. And what's the second mechanism that draws potassium inside the cell? It is the, that protein right there produces an electrical gradient. Okay. So, another question I have, can this protein draw in enough potassium ions to completely neutralize the negative charges on this protein? Okay. Okay, if there's enough potassium, you might think that's true. But what happens if we put a high concentration of potassium inside the cell higher than outside? What does potassium want to do? It's going to want to leave, right? So there is a new balance that is established, right, to where you can't get enough potassium inside the cell to exactly neutralize all the negative charges on this protein, because as soon as you get enough potassium inside the cell, the concentration gradient is huge, it's going to start to diffuse back out. Okay? So under those conditions, when you can't get enough potassium inside the cell, then the overall charge inside the cell becomes negative as a result of that. And it didn't require any energy for that to happen. So the inside of the cell becomes negative compared to the outside of the cell, because not enough potassium can get in there to electrically neutralize these proteins. Because as soon as you bring up the concentration of potassium, then it's going to want to leave, just down its concentration gradient. So there's a new equilibrium established where you have a higher concentration of potassium inside the cell compared to the outside, which then produces a negative charge inside compared to the outside of the cell. Okay, so there are two effects. And that's what we see on this slide right here. So now I'm going to turn some of the lights down. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet, because that's your receipt that you were here in class. Okay, so this slide kind of describes, right, what I just drew on the board. There are two forces that can move ions around across a membrane. And what are the two forces? It is the electrical attraction. And the second one is the concentration, right? Because concentration can move things across the membrane, and electrical attraction can move things across the membrane. So these things added together will form a new equilibrium that will determine the amount of potassium inside the cell. And we're just ignoring sodium and other ions at the moment. Okay. So hopefully that kind of rings a bell. You can kind of see what's happening right there. If not, then maybe come see me during office hours. Okay, so, and what kind of ion is potassium? I see it on this slide. It's a cation. Yeah, it's a cation. I see cation right here. And what kind of cation? It's a monovalent cation, right? And what about sodium? It's a monovalent cation. That's how we would talk about it. Okay, so, yeah. These things have to exactly balance out. If we leave this cell alone for a long period of time, then there is a new equilibrium where the concentration gradient trying to force potassium out of the cell exactly matches up with the electrical attraction bringing potassium inside the cell. The first condition that I drew on the board, the only thing that was operating was a concentration gradient, right? And when the concentration gradient went away, potassium wouldn't move one way or the other. But if we put some negative charges inside the cell, then that's going to draw more potassium in because it's attracted, which means then that's going to disrupt the concentration gradient. It's not going to be equal on the inside and outside the cell. There's going to be more potassium on the inside, right? And it's going to get more and more potassium on the inside, but then there's going to be a point where the concentration gradient is so large that some of the potassium will leak out. Right, but then you still have more potassium inside the cell compared to outside. Right? But the force for the concentration gradient will be matched by the electrical attraction. So try to break the mechanism down here for potassium movement across the membrane into those two pieces. Right, the two pieces are electrical attraction, bringing potassium in, and it builds up a lot of potassium inside the cell, and that takes us to the second item, which is a concentration gradient. If it's high inside the cell and low outside, then potassium wants to move outside the cell by what kind of mechanism? If it's high concentration potassium inside the cell, low outside, what is moving? How would we describe that process? What's moving potassium outside the cell? Yeah, it's a concentration gradient going from high to low. What do we call that? That's diffusion. And what kind of transport mechanism is that? That's passive. That's right. So that's passive. And even this electrical action right here, that's a passive mechanism. Okay. So the cell becomes negative on the inside just passively because of these proteins inside the cell that are trapped. They can't get out. That's kind of fascinating that living cells just become batteries just because of the way they're built. Okay. Okay, so we can actually measure that difference in charge across the membrane with something we call a voltmeter. So here is a voltmeter, and we could put one of these voltmeters on the terminals of your battery or the battery that you have to drive your cell phone or whatever, and we can measure that voltage or that potential. And when we do, of course you need a really fine needle to get inside of a cell, okay, but they're pretty easy to make. You can make a really thin needle that goes right through the cell membrane and hook it up to a voltmeter, and you can see that you read what kind of voltage? Yeah, negative 90 millivolts. Okay, it's negative on the inside compared to the outside of the cell. So the outside of the cell is positive compared to the inside, or the inside is negative compared to the outside of the cell. So that's a pretty good number that you should be aware of. Okay, that's a good place to start. All right, but that is, all right, built up by what? Two kinds of forces: electrical attraction bringing potassium in, and then the concentration gradient, potassium trying to diffuse out. These things have to form a new balance, and when that happens, you get minus 90 millivolts negative on the inside. So potassium going into the cell, there's not enough potassium that can get in there to make this number go to zero. Because as soon as you start bringing in more potassium, what happens? Then it starts to diffuse out. Okay, there's a new equilibrium that is established. Okay, so what does this look like? Okay, every cell in your body then looks like a battery, right? Because there are two places that have an electrical difference. This is what we call the equilibrium potential for potassium, right? And it just develops all by itself, and that's written down E sub K. And there are equilibrium potentials by other ions in your body as well, developed just the same reason. So there's an E sodium, so you would put an Na right here. Right, that's the equilibrium potential. And how can we calculate that? We can calculate it for each of these ions. And we calculate it using the Nernst equation, and this is one of the equations why you need that log button on your calculator. What's another reason why you need a log button on your calculator? Yeah, to calculate pH, right? Okay, so this Nernst equation right here gives us the membrane voltage needed to counteract the concentration gradient forces. Remember, they're operating in different directions. One is pulling potassium inside the cell. Which one of these effects is pulling potassium inside the cell? The electrical or the concentration gradient? The electrical attraction, that's right. Okay. All right, so the value of that equilibrium depends on the ratio of ion concentrations inside and outside the cell, and that's what we have right here. All right, so we have this X. This is the concentration of some kind of molecule, like sodium or potassium, that's outside the cell, and X right here is the concentration inside the cell. And so we divide one by the other, take the log of it, and there should be like a 10 right here, base 10 log. There are other kinds of logs. Make sure you hit the log button and not like an ln button on your calculator, so you could go wrong there. All right, and then you got to multiply that number by 61. That's just a constant of proportionality. It never changes. All right, so if you're going to use this equation on a test, I'll give it to you. So you don't have to memorize 61, but you have to know what numbers to plug in here for X out, X in, and also Z. Okay, and Z is the valence of that particular ion. Like for sodium, what would be the valence? It would just be 1, right, because it's a monovalent cation. So I would put a plus 1 right here. So what's 61 divided by plus 1? It's just plain old 61, right? It doesn't change. But now, let's put, if this was chloride, what number would we put right here? What is chloride ion? Is it a cation? It's an anion. It has a negative charge, and how many negative charges? It has actually just one negative charge on it, so it's a monovalent anion. So for Z, we would put here a minus 1, and what's 61 divided by a minus 1? Just minus 61. Okay. There are some ions, like magnesium, that are plus 2, and calcium is plus 2, so if we want to calculate the equilibrium potential for calcium, what number would we have to put in for Z? Since it's a divalent cation, it would be a plus 2 right here in the denominator, so then you'd have to take 61 and divide it by 2, right, to get the multiplier for this log function. Okay, so that's how you would use the Nernst equation. Now, on this slide, I do want you to memorize some things. Not the numbers necessarily, but at least the gradient of some important ions that are in your body. Okay, and remember, when you have a gradient, it can also be considered an energy source, right? So that's important to remember. So all of these things are gradients, and you can consider these things like an energy source for a cell. So here are the important ions. You got to know what Na stands for, what K stands for, Cl stands for, and Ca. I think I gave you a table of important chemical symbols that you have to know the words for. So we have these four ions, and you can see sodium, potassium, and chloride are monovalent, and calcium is divalent. You can see a 2 right there. Okay, chlorine is an anion. Sodium, potassium, and calcium, these are cations. And we can use the Nernst equation, right, to calculate the membrane potential for one of these ions at a time. Okay, a Nernst equation can't be used to figure out what the equilibrium potential when we use all of these ions at the same time, but of course your cell uses them all together. We just can't calculate it mathematically with this particular equation. All right, but I think it's still instructive to know what the equilibrium potential is for each of these individually all by themselves, and you would use the Nernst equation right here to calculate that. All right, so what's important about sodium? And you kind of know the important thing about sodium already, right? And where is that at a high concentration? That's outside the cell. And do you see that on this figure? Yeah, it's 45 millimolar outside and only 12 millimolar inside the cell. I don't want you to memorize those numbers, but I do want you to memorize that sodium is high outside the cell. That's really important. What about potassium? Where is it high? Inside the cell. And then here are the numbers, 150 millimolar inside, only 5 millimolar outside. What about chlorine? If this is a nice, healthy cell, is it high inside or outside? It's high outside, 125 millimolar versus 9. And what about calcium? Where is it at a high concentration? Outside the cell as well. So it's almost what? It's almost zero on the inside of the cell if the cell is nice and quiet. And the outside is 2.5. Okay. All right, so you should know which ions are high concentration inside the cell and which are high outside the cell, because you're going to have to develop a feeling for what's going on with each of these ions right here in terms of how the cell is controlled and how that cell interacts with the rest of your body. All right, so let's calculate the equilibrium potential for potassium. How would you use this equation right here? What would you put in for X out? What's the number? We'd have to put a number in here. Okay, X out is, here's potassium. Outside is 5 millimolar. And what is the inside? X in would be 150. So you take 5, divide it by 150, take the log of it, multiply it by 61 divided by plus 1, right, which is just 61, and then you would get the equilibrium potential, right, in terms of millivolts developed by the potassium. What about for sodium? How would you calculate the equilibrium potential for sodium? What would we put out? What would we put here for X out? We would put for sodium, we put 145, and then for X, oh, I'm sorry, for X in, we'd put 12, and then for X out right here, we would put 145, figure out what that number is, take the log of it, and then multiply it by 61, right, because Z is plus 1. Now, if this was calcium, okay, we would put outside 2.5, inside 0.0001, and then take the log of that, and then multiply it by 61, is that correct? No, it would be 61 divided by 2. Okay, and that would tell you the equilibrium potential. Because calcium, let's look at calcium right here. Let's look at this circle. Do you see a 2 in that circle?
Yeah.
Indeed there is, right? Because that's the valence of calcium. It likes to give away 2 electrons. And when it gives away 2 electrons, it becomes a cation with a plus 2 charge, or a bivalent, sometimes we say divalent cation under those circumstances. All right, so you can see how a lot of these electrical things develop. And, of course, the equilibrium potential for potassium is minus 90 millivolts. The equilibrium potential for sodium is 60 millivolts. And okay, you know, I don't have a calculator handy, but I think that is maybe a homework problem or something for you. I don't think I have the answer on these slides. But stop by my office. Let's calculate it. Okay, but yeah, because you should be able to calculate it. All right, so when the cell is at rest, when it's not doing anything, these are the concentrations of these ions across the cell membrane, and it produces a voltage, and we call that the resting membrane potential. And I think from now on, I just want to call that RMP. RMP is resting membrane potential when the cell is not doing anything. It's alive, the pumps are working, but it's not sending information anywhere. There's no action potentials taking place. It's just at rest. The RMP for most cells is somewhere between minus 65 and minus 85 millivolts, depending on what kind of cell it is. And so we're going to pick a number of minus 70 because it's right in the middle. Right? So if I use a minus 70 millivolts, you're going to say that cell is at what? RMP, at rest, resting membrane potential. Right, and remember, resting membrane potential is due to a couple things. One thing is the concentrations of ions inside and outside the cell, and something that I haven't talked about yet, and that's the permeability of each ion across the membrane or through the membrane. That's really important, but we don't get to really play around with that in a mathematical equation. That's a different kind of equation. Right, some physiology classes at this level we talk about, it's called a Goldman equation. And then we use permeability. And when we use a Goldman equation, we can lump all of the ions together in one equation, and it gives us a more perfect answer, right, for what's happening inside of a real cell. Okay. Resting membrane potential is affected most by potassium because potassium can leak out of the cell. Right? There are channels that allow, they're called leak channels, that allow potassium to leak out. Right, because it's potassium is high inside the cell, and if it can leak out, what happens to the charge inside the cell? Yeah, it becomes more negative, right? So that's why permeability is important to consider. So here is a typical cell that we're going to be dealing with. What's RMP of this cell? Minus 70, right? And here we see that some sodium diffuses in, so RMP is a little bit less negative than the equilibrium potential for potassium. So these are just a whole bunch of things that intuitively don't go together. I'm just describing how we come up with this minus 70, right? So When some sodium enters the cell, even though the membrane is not very permeable to sodium, but what happens to the inside of the cell when sodium goes in? It becomes less negative. That's something I think that should be intuitive for you. Okay, something else that establishes the membrane potential just besides that Nernst equation is what? That sodium-potassium ATP pump. We said it's electrogenic. It pumps in two potassiums, but it pumps out three sodiums, so that makes the cell a little bit more negative, right? That adds about minus 3 millivolts to the resting membrane potential. That's pretty important. All right, so here's a slide that kind of glumps all of this stuff together. Okay, and this doesn't work in a nice algebraic fashion, so I don't have a nice algebra equation to show you, but these are some of the considerations, right, that you have to think about to get to this RMP of minus 70 millivolts. Well, there are fixed anions inside the cell. What does that make the cell, negative or positive? It makes it a little bit negative, a lot negative compared to the outside. So that affects RMP, the resting membrane potential. Right, and then there are unequal permeabilities of the plasma membrane to sodium and potassium. Right, so potassium is more permeable, more positives can leak out than sodium can leak in, so that makes the inside, what, a little more negative, right? That works with these fixed anions right here. And then you have that sodium-potassium pump, right, and what does that make the cell? A little bit more negative on the inside, right, because it's pumping 3 versus 2. And then, because of the equilibrium potential for potassium and sodium, you're going to calculate a plus millivolt for sodium because it's outside the cell, minus millivolts for potassium because it's inside the cell. And if you put all of these effects together, right, and we're not going to do that in a nice, clean, algebraic way, we're just going to tell you what it is, right? And it is minus 70 millivolts for a typical cell that we're going to be looking at. Right, so these are all things that you could probably look at to see that the inside of the cell is going to end up to be negative compared to the outside of the cell. Right, so you got the equilibrium potential, the electrogenic pump, you got those anions, and permeability to these ions as well. All added together, summed together, gives you about minus 70 millivolts. We're going to be working with that number a lot. And if a cell is at minus 70 millivolts, what can you tell me about the state of that cell? The state of the cell, is it working or is it at rest? Yeah, it's at rest, okay? And that cell might love to do some work, okay, but for whatever reason it's not, it's at rest, okay? And if that membrane potential is minus 70 millivolts, you also know that cell is alive. But if the cell just stays at 0 millivolts, what could you tell me about that cell? It's dead, right? So that membrane potential is important to maintain life processes inside the cell. All right, so that's an introduction to some electrical properties of cells, and we're going to leave it right there until we get to the nervous system, because the nervous system works by these electrical properties of cells, and we're going to revisit RMP again and talk about other kinds of changes across the cell membrane that change the electrical properties of cells. Okay, so let's talk about cell signaling. How can cells communicate with other cells in your body? Okay, and the best way to think about that is to think about a synapse, right? And on this slide I have the synapse is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. Right, so it has to have a certain structure. If it has the proper kind of structure, then it's going to have the proper function, right? So we want to look at both the structure, right, and then understand what function comes from that as well. There are two general kinds of synapses, at least the way that I think, and this is a good way to initially think about communication between cells. There are electrical synapses and chemical synapses. All right, so if it's an electrical synapse, what is transferred from one cell to another? Charge. That's right, some kind of electrical form. And if it's a chemical synapse, what's transferred between cells? Not electrical charge, but a chemical of some kind. Okay? So let's take a look at these two in particular. And the first one we're going to look at is what we call an electrical synapse, and your body does not have very many of these, but one important organ is just loaded with these things, right? So one organ really is controlled by electrical synapses, and that is the heart. So here I see a nice plasma membrane. You can see a phospholipid bilayer. And what can you tell me about sodium on the outside of this heart cell compared to the inside? It's high on the outside. Yeah, it's positive, and it's high on the outside, low on the inside. Okay, when the cell becomes excited, that sodium is going to enter the cell. It's going to open up a sodium channel right here, and it's going to rush down its concentration gradient. What's going to happen to the electrical property of this cell? The inside now becomes less negative, becomes more positive. That is an excitatory event that eventually will lead to contraction of the cell. All right, but now we have high sodium in this top cell and low sodium in the bottom cell. So what does sodium want to do? Yeah. It wants to diffuse from the top cell into the bottom cell. And look at this big channel right here. It allows sodium to diffuse into this bottom cell. And, of course, it's bringing a positive charge with it. So what happens to the electrical properties of this bottom cell? It becomes less negative. So the top cell becomes less negative, the bottom cell becomes less negative because of these gap junctions. And gap junctions we always find in intercalated discs. And maybe you have a picture of what a myocardial cell looks like, or a group of them, what a histological cell line looks like. So all myocardial cells are connected together with these gap junctions so that if one cell is stimulated, or we say depolarized, all of the cells become less negative on the inside. That's an excitatory event that's going to cause the heart to contract as a unit. Only one cell has to be stimulated, and the whole heart, all the cells in the heart, become stimulated. All right, so that happens to cardiac muscle, and that is super important because in order for the heart to pump blood, right, the whole heart has to contract as a unit. One part can't contract, then relax while another part is contracting. Right? If one part is contracting while another part is relaxed, then blood is just going to swish around inside the heart and not go to your brain. And then how many seconds of consciousness do you have? You got 2 seconds, right? So the heart has to contract as a unit to pump blood. When the heart doesn't contract as a unit, we call that fibrillation. Okay, very serious situation. But the reason why the heart can contract as a unit because of these gap junctions, and sodium can move from one cell to another very rapidly, and that's an excitation for all the myocardial cells. Now, do you think that skeletal muscle would be controlled the same way? Does skeletal muscle have a gap junction? Let's try to figure this. And I see some people shaking their head no, and that's a great answer. All right, because skeletal muscle is under voluntary control. Right, your mind can tell this biceps to contract, when to relax, right? And when I tell it to contract, can't make up its own mind, it just contracts, right? But if all the skeletal muscle cells in your body had gap junctions, when you tell the biceps to contract, it would contract, but what would happen to all the other muscles in your body? They would contract too. So I'm thirsty, I would like some Coke to drink right there. So I contract his biceps. If I had electrical synapses, I could never reach it, right, because all my muscles would be contracted at the same time. So skeletal muscle is not controlled by electrical synapses via these gap junctions. It's controlled by chemical synapses, which have a very limited effect, and that's why chemical synapses are great. Okay. Okay, so which type of synapse has a gap junction? Electrical, because sodium can flow from one cell to another, and since sodium is an electrically charged particle, right, not only can you consider that diffusion, but you can consider that an electrical current. An electrical current is just a charge that's in motion going from one place to another. Okay, here's the other kind of cell signaling. And here I see a chemical being produced by one cell, that cell secretes it, and then it moves by diffusion, okay, someplace else, and it's going to bump into another cell, and it can change the physiology of this second cell over here. And if these cells are close to each other, we're going to call that a paracrine reagent or a regulator, okay? And in order for this cell right here to respond to a chemical signal, okay, it has to have a receptor for it. So there has to be some kind of protein that matches up with the signaling molecule. And you can kind of think of the hand and glove example or lock and key example. So it's just based by shape. The shape of the receptor has to be complementary to the shape of the signaling molecule. All right, so here I see a nice spherical or round signaling molecule. What has to be the shape of the receptor here? Should it be triangular? No, it won't fit in. Can it be square?
No.
It has to be what? It has to be circular, right? It has to be circular in the opposite sense that the signaling molecule is. Right, so things match up by shape. And if you change the shape of the receptor, what happens to the system? It just doesn't function, right? The physiology changes. Okay, so this is still a synapse, but this is what we call a chemical synapse. And it only works if the tissue right here has receptors for this particular signaling compound. And if these cells have the receptor for this signaling compound, we call it a target tissue. And so another way of saying what a target tissue is that it has receptors for some kind of signaling compound. So another concept is you can say that this cell right here that's secreting a signaling compound can affect what? What kind of tissue? A target tissue. But that is kind of a loaded term because now you know a target tissue has what always? A receptor to it. All right, so a tissue that doesn't have a receptor to the signaling molecule is not a target tissue, and it's going to completely ignore that chemical signal. It won't respond to it one way or the other. Okay. All right, so here is a really good example of a chemical synapse. And your book actually likes to call this a synapse and not really talk about electrical synapses too much, but it'd be good, I think, for you to break a synapse down into those two different forms. All right, for a chemical synapse, here we have a neuron, and you recognize that as a neuron because here's the cell body. We got some dendrites and a long axon, and I think in anatomy you even learned about myelination of axons right here. Here's the axon terminal. So this neuron transmits information as an electrical signal because of the way potassium and sodium flow across the membrane. We're going to look at that in chapters coming up. So an electrical signal just zips down this axon. Okay, when that electrical signal gets down to the axon terminus, right, it can't get into the muscle cell over here. Even if they were touching, it couldn't get across because the cell membrane would prevent that. But notice that these two cells, the muscle cell and the neuron, are not even touching each other. So the only way an electrical signal could go from the neuron to the muscle is like a lightning bolt. Okay, and we don't have any lightning bolts working in our body. All right, so it can't be electrical. So your body then uses a chemical. So the neuron secretes a chemical, it diffuses over to this muscle cell, and it's a target tissue, which means what? It has a receptor to this neurotransmitter. We call this a neurotransmitter because it's coming from a neuron, and it's transmitting information across the synapse. All right, and when neurotransmitter binds to a receptor on the muscle cell, it's going to start another electrical signal, and an electrical signal flows over the whole muscle cell. And that electrical signal is going to be very much like the electrical signal that's on this neuron. Right? So for a chemical synapse, right? First in the proximal cell, you have an electrical signal. It's converted into a chemical signal, which then is converted back to an electrical signal in the distal cell. Sometimes we call this the presynaptic membrane on the neuron, and we call the membrane on the muscle cell the postsynaptic membrane. Okay? And which membrane has a receptor? The presynaptic or postsynaptic? Yeah, the postsynaptic cell. Okay. And information only travels in one direction, from the presynaptic cell to the postsynaptic cell. That's something, you might find some examples where that doesn't happen, but generally that's what happens. Okay, and information only flows in one direction because only the distal cell right here, the postsynaptic membrane, has a receptor. Right? We usually don't have receptors on the presynaptic membrane for this neurotransmitter. Okay, here's another kind of cell signaling. It doesn't require electrical signals, right? But it has to do with the endocrine system. So here we have a tissue. And this tissue is producing this chemical, and we could probably name a couple, but we're just going to call it generally a hormone. All right, so it produces a hormone and secretes it via some secretory pathway into the interstitial space. And remember, the interstitial space is loaded with what kind of material? What is most of your body made out of? water, right? So this interstitial space has water. So when this hormone gets secreted outside the cell, it can diffuse through that water. That's why we have water all over our body, so diffusion can take place. And so this hormone is going to go from high concentration inside the cell to low concentration inside the blood. Just that, so it's just a passive process, right? And so this is a blood vessel, but you should be able to tell me what kind of blood vessel that is. What does that look like? This is a blast from the past when you were in anatomy. What kind of blood vessel is that? And maybe you said, and I wasn't listening. Now I'll listen. It's a blood vessel, so it can't be a nerve. It's a capillary. Remember, you have arteries, veins, and capillaries, maybe some subclasses of each of those. All right, but this is a capillary, and a capillary is the only kind of blood vessel where exchange can take place, right? Things can't leave the blood in a vein or an artery. Things can't enter the blood in a vein or an artery. It can only enter or leave through a capillary, right? So it's specialized for exchange. Does anybody know why things can only diffuse across the capillary wall and not a wall of a vein or an artery? Because the wall of an artery and a vein, I think I kind of heard it, is thick, right? And diffusion is really limited by distance, right? And also the walls of arteries and veins are impermeable to most substances, but it's mostly because they're way too thick for diffusion to work, okay? So this hormone diffuses, gets picked up by this capillary, put in the blood, and then when it's in the blood, where does it go? It goes everywhere where the blood goes, which is most places in your body. And when it gets to a place in your body where there's no hormone, then the concentration is low, but it's high in the blood. What will that hormone like to do? Just diffuse out of the blood. And where can it diffuse out? In a capillary, right, in that particular organ. And so the hormone diffuses out. Oh, here's the diffusion part, diffusing out. Okay, and it can regulate the activity of these cells over here if they have what? If they have a receptor. And if they have a receptor, we talk about this as a target tissue or target organ. Okay, and if it doesn't have a receptor, it won't be a target tissue, will not respond to that particular hormone. Okay, so this is a nice definition of a hormone. Right, a hormone is transported to a distant location via the blood system. It's not by any kind of duct or any other kind of system. Right, a hormone is distributed by the blood. And here is the gland that secretes it. A gland that secretes a hormone is an endocrine gland. And it's an endocrine gland because, why? Does anybody know the definition, remember the definition of endocrine versus exocrine? Yeah, endocrine is a ductless gland. It doesn't need a duct because it uses the cardiovascular system. And an exocrine gland has to have a duct to take its product someplace in the body where it might have some effect. Okay. So that hormone, we got generally two classes of hormones. And some of the hormones are made out of amino acids, which are soluble in water, which means they're polar compounds. And some hormones are made from cholesterol. And where does cholesterol fit in? What kind of biomolecule is cholesterol? It's a lipid, yep. And cholesterol is modified to become various kinds of hormones like testosterone and estrogen and thyroid hormone and all the other steroids. All right, and what can you tell me about a lipid? Is it polar or nonpolar? It's nonpolar. So they don't really like to mix in water, but they can be carried in the blood if they have a little transporter to bind to, all right? But because they are nonpolar, okay, or what we call hydrophobic, can they diffuse through the cell membrane? Okay, what is the interior part of the cell membrane again, polar or nonpolar? It's nonpolar, so nonpolar molecules can diffuse across the cell membrane. Nonpolar hormones or hydrophobic hormones can enter a cell just by diffusion, which is passive. Right, so now you have that signaling compound inside the cell, but in order for this to be a target tissue, what does it have to have? A receptor, right? And the receptors are inside the cell because the hormone can get in there. It's not barred by the cell membrane. So the hormone binds to a receptor, and then it changes the physiology of the cell because most of these hormones, when they bind to this receptor, okay, move into the nucleus, right, and activate genes, and those activated genes, right, produce proteins, which have an effect on the cell, okay? And so These molecules, hydrophobic molecules, can initiate protein synthesis. But as you can imagine, that takes a little while for it to happen. It's not instantaneous because the nucleus then has to make RNA, and then RNA has to be converted into a protein, right? That process we call protein synthesis, and there's two steps to protein synthesis that we're going to look at. Did we look at those steps? I'm not sure. I don't think we did yet in this class. Okay, but protein synthesis has two steps, and they occur inside the cell. We'll talk about those later on. All right, so hydrophobic regulatory molecules have to have a cytoplasmic receptor, right? So I kind of modified this slide. I stuck in cytoplasmic. All right, now what about polar or hydrophilic molecules? Can they get across the cell membrane?
No.
They cannot. So where does the cell receptor have to be? Can't be inside the cell because the signaling compound can never get in. It has to be on the extracellular side of the membrane. All right, so that's the next slide right here. All right, so hydrophilic regulatory molecules have to have a receptor that's on the outside of the plasma membrane. And of course, that receptor has to obey all the right kind of receptor rules. It has to be complementary in shape to the signaling molecule. Right, and when it binds to that receptor, then it's going to change the physiology that's happening inside the cell. And it could be due to some kind of electrical change or maybe a chemical change. It could be a number of different things. All right, so this was a mystery, right, for a long time, because people could measure this signaling compound and they could watch changes inside the cell, but they could never figure out how that compound got across the membrane. And indeed, it never got into the cell. So how can you say that something outside the cell can make something inside the cell change? Right? And this is a nice model to think about how that happens. Okay. So for instance, a hormone that's outside the cell binds to a receptor on the outside, and that protein goes all the way across the membrane, and the protein on this side of the membrane, on the interior side, the cytoplasmic side, is going to then create a second messenger. So a second messenger, another chemical, okay, then forms inside the cell, and that second chemical then changes the physiology inside the cell. So this is what we call the first messenger, second messenger theory of how information can go across the cell membrane, even though that first messenger can't get across because it's hydrophilic. Okay, so a couple questions. Where do you always find the first messenger? Outside the cell. Where do you always find the second messenger? Inside the cell. Okay, but there still has to be a receptor, but that's got to be outside the cell. All right, so what are some second messengers? Here are some commonly used second messengers, right? And where would we find these things? Inside the cell. Not when the cell is at rest, but when it is being signaled to do something, right? These messengers are built inside the cell when that cell is being signaled to change its physiology. So some ions are second messengers. And calcium is a really good example, because when the cell's at rest, what can you tell me about intracellular calcium? Okay, when that cell is at rest, what about calcium on the inside of the cell? High concentration or low? Go back to that slide and you'll see it's almost zero. When the cell is at rest, it's at zero, but when it's being signaled, that calcium builds up to a high level inside the cell, and then the cell changes its activity. So calcium, okay, is what we call a second messenger. Cyclic AMP can be another second messenger. It's really low inside the cell unless it's being signaled, and there are enzymes that can take an ATP molecule and break off two phosphates so that there's only one phosphate left that becomes a monophosphate. And the special kind of monophosphate forms a ring, and we call that cyclic AMP. It has a special kind of structure, and it only is inside the cell when it's being signaled by a special kind of pathway. Another kind of second messenger is a G protein. We're going to look at this in a little bit. And then there are two others here that we're going to talk about later on in the class, and that's DAG and IPI3. But we're not going to talk about those right now. But there are a couple different kinds of second messengers. And so where are you going to find IPI3? Inside the cell or outside the cell? Inside the cell when it's being signaled. When the cell's at rest, right, it will be low concentration. Okay, so those are some important second messengers. There is second messenger system that we can find in almost every living cell. So we say it's highly conserved. So it could be an ancient cell line, way before any kind of animals ever inhabited the earth, right? Millions of years ago, have G proteins as a way to send a signal from outside the cell to inside the cell. Okay, so G proteins are part of a second messenger pathway. We can find them in almost every living cell. And a G protein has three subunits, right? But I really want to show you a picture of this thing, right? Rather than read this. All this is really true, and it relates really nicely to this picture. All right, so let's talk about this picture right here. This is a way for information to go from outside the cell to inside the cell, even though the regulatory molecule is hydrophilic. If it's hydrophilic, what can you tell me about the polarity? It's kind of a mind teaser. It's polar, and if it's polar, it can't get through the nonpolar region in the membrane, right? So it's stuck outside the cell. So where does the receptor have to be? Extracellular, on the membrane, outside the cell, and indeed, that's what I see. So here is the receptor. The regulatory molecule binds to it by shape, right? It has to be complementary in shape, and that activates the receptor, which goes across the membrane. It's just a protein that has many parts on the outside, on the inside, and then in the middle of the membrane and then on the inside of the membrane. Bound to this receptor is what we call the G protein. So these three circles, and they're probably red. Are they red? Yeah, these red things are the G protein. Okay? And how many pieces make up a G protein? And you can see three. There is number one, number two, and number three. But we don't call it that. We just say alpha, which is A, beta, which is really a B, and gamma is a little bit later on down in the alphabet, the Greek alphabet, right? So you got three subunits, and I don't care if you think that the alpha is bigger than the other two. I don't even know if it is, but there are three subunits, okay? And we call this a G protein because this alpha subunit right here has a binding site for GTP. And GTP is very similar to ATP, right? Guanosine is just a nucleotide, just like adenosine is. Right, so it's a high-energy compound. It's a high-energy compound, just like ATP is, but it's got guanosine. So GTP can bind to this alpha subunit, and when it does, it throws away a GDP molecule that has been bound to the alpha subunit, so there's an exchange taking place. Right, so there's a receptor site for this guanosine triphosphate, and it's going to kick out this guanosine diphosphate. And when that happens, it activates the G protein. When GTP binds to this alpha subunit, it becomes activated, and that GTP, remember, has energy in it, just like an ATP molecule. All right, so these things get activated, these three subunits, and they can break away from the receptor, and they can break away from each other as well. So they dissociate into the gamma and beta subunit and an alpha subunit. And they're released from the receptor, and they can wander around on the surface of the plasma membrane on the inside of the cell, and they can move from high concentration to low, so that just by diffusion, they're going to diffuse right on that surface of the membrane. So they move around on the plasma membrane, and they can bump into other proteins that are in the cell membrane. And these other proteins we're going to call effectors. And what the heck is an effector? What does it do? You had to draw this in lab. It's already burned in your mind, but you're concentrating on this. An effector produces a response. Okay, so here's a protein that's an effector. It's going to produce a response. We're going to talk about some of those responses, but generally I just want to talk about it. So when the beta and gamma subunit bump into this effector, it's going to turn it on. And when the effector is turned on, it's going to produce a response. Right? If the beta and gamma subunit don't bump into the effector, it doesn't produce a response. Right? So this right here is what we call a G protein coupled receptor, and it can change, it can produce responses inside the cell because these subunits, once they become activated by this GTP, and binding of this regulatory molecule can change these effectors, can turn them on, right? And the alpha subunit can do the same thing, right? It can bump into an effector, and that effector can produce a response. All right, some classes of effectors. Maybe one class of effectors is an enzyme. Right, so when the alpha subunit bumps into this enzyme, turns it on, and an enzyme then can build other kinds of chemicals inside the cell. Or maybe this is a channel, and when the beta and gamma subunit bump into this channel, it can open the channel to allow diffusion of certain compounds, or if it's a channel that's open, it could close the channel and prevent diffusion of certain things across the cell membrane. Right, so those would all be responses. And then after the effector produces that response, the subunits are released and they diffuse around again on the surface, inside surface of the cell membrane, and they join together once again, and right as they're joining together, that GTP is hydrolyzed to GDP, and inorganic phosphate is a result of that. Okay, so that's kind of where the energy comes from. And now this receptor is what? It is charged back up with energy, waiting for a signal to go to work once again. All right, so if there's a regulatory molecule that binds to this receptor because it has the proper shape, right, then this GDP is released, GTP is bound to it, and the cycle repeats itself over and over again. All right, so this regulatory molecule, where do you find this regulatory molecule all the time? Outside the cell. What kind of messenger is that? First messenger, outside the cell. And the G protein right here, where do you find it always? Inside the cell, and it becomes activated when the regulatory molecule binds to the receptor, right? And it's a messenger because it's activating these effectors right here. So it, what kind of messenger is it? It's a secondary messenger because it's always inside the cell. Okay, so this is what we call a G protein coupled receptor. One scheme that we know how information that's trapped outside the cell can actually create information that is inside the cell right here. So that's a very important mechanism. We're going to look at that a number of times throughout the class. All right, so that's it for chapter 6. All right, is that the last chapter on the test? No, it's not. Chapter 3 is also on the test. So I think maybe we should take a peek at chapter 3. All right, so you guys can start working on chapter 3 over the weekend so that you have a lot of time to prepare for that test coming up. So I'm going to end this show unless somebody has a question. Okay, where are receptors for a polar signaling compound? A polar signaling compound. Outside the cell because they can't get in. Right, for a nonpolar signaling compound, where are the receptors? Inside the cell. And what's the response inside the cell when a nonpolar signaling compound enters? Okay, I don't know if you studied the slides enough to see that, but it's always protein synthesis. Protein synthesis ensues, right, when there's a lipid signaling compound, like a steroid hormone. Okay. Great. All right, so let's look at chapter 3. I don't even know what chapter 3 is, but we're going to find out what it is. I'm sure it's something fun and amazing. Cell structure and genetic control, genetic function. This is kind of a lot like anatomy, so a lot of this is going to be a review for you in some sense. All right, so let's go to pointer options right here, arrow options, visible. Okay, so we're going to look at the plasma membrane. You probably have two ways to think about the plasma membrane in your mind. One is a very simple model. The other is more complicated, more realistic model of a cell membrane. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? What's a simple model? We call that the phospholipid bilayer, okay, without any proteins in it or anything. What's the building block of the phospholipid bilayer? It's a phospholipid, right, the phospholipid. And you should know kind of how it forms because we looked at how micelles form because of the polar and nonpolar nature of that phospholipid molecule. And we're going to look at some organelles that we find in the cytoplasm. Depends on how recent the book was written. Organelle is really part of a cytoplasm. A lot of times early on, people considered the fluid part inside the cell cytoplasm. Right, but now we know that cytoplasm is made up of organelles and the liquid part, which we call cytosol. Right, so cytosol and organelles make cytoplasm. We're going to look at gene expression and DNA replication and the cell cycle. Maybe not very much. What's the cell cycle? What's one important step in the cell cycle that you're really familiar with from anatomy? Mitosis, for instance, right? So you can go ahead and review that, especially if there are some questions, online questions, or at the end of the chapter. But I probably won't spend a lot of time, unless you guys got questions about mitosis. Okay, if it's been a long time since you took anatomy, then you'll have to look at it a little bit more closely. Okay, so here is a cell. And remember, what did I say about a synapse? What is one way to characterize a synapse? It's the structural and functional unit of what? Of communication between cells, right? Structural and functional unit of communication. So I like to use that as a theme throughout the class, all right, for not just communication, but for other things. So what we're looking at right here is the structural and functional unit of life. Is really the good way to think about this thing, right? So if something is alive, it has to be made up of cells, right? So I have to define what a cell is for us, okay? A cell has genetic material, right? And that genetic material could be DNA, and in some circumstances it could be RNA, but it has to be some kind of genetic material that can be transferred from one generation to another. It has to have cytoplasm. Right. So here is cytoplasm. The genetic material could be dissolved in the cytoplasm, or if it's a really sophisticated cell, it could be separated from the cytoplasm by the nuclear envelope. But as long as it has genetic material and cytoplasm, that's two important criteria. And again, what is cytoplasm again? Cytosol and organelles, so it's got to have those, both of those things. And the third thing that a cell has to have is a plasma membrane that separates the living world inside the cell compared to the non-living world that's outside the cell. So a cell has to have plasma membrane, cytoplasm, and genetic material. Genetic material, all three of those things. And of course, those little things inside our body have all three of these things, so we call those cells. And are we alive? Yes, because we have all those three things inside of ourselves. Okay. So that's the structural and functional unit of life. All right, so it's a highly organized molecular factory. These organelles are made from molecules. That's the building block of organelles. All right, so this slide is a little misleading. Right, it says three main components of a cell: plasma membrane. That's what I said. Cytoplasm is what I said. But what else did I say? I said organelles are really a part of cytoplasm. Okay, so cytoplasm, which includes cytosol and organelles. But what's the third thing missing from here that I said? Genetic material. That's a really nice modern way of thinking of what a cell is, right? Because if it has genetic material, it can make another cell that comes from the same lineage as the cell, right? So it can reproduce itself. All right, so that's a cell. And usually we start thinking about the plasma membrane first. And indeed, we said a good way to think about the plasma membrane in simple form is that it's a phospholipid bilayer. And what can you tell me about phospholipid bilayers? Do they build themselves easily, or do you need a lot of complicated machinery to make a phospholipid bilayer? It's really simple. These things just self-assemble themselves because of these polar head groups of the phospholipid here that are facing the water environment that's extracellular, intracellular, and then the inner parts of this membrane are the nonpolar regions, the lipid regions, so they kind of like to stick together, right? So this membrane will just build itself as long as you have enough phospholipid molecules. All right, but that doesn't really tell the whole story of this membrane because I see a lot of other things that can be inserted into the membrane, and it's the job of the nucleus to build these things, and if they're built properly, they get inserted into the cell membrane. Okay, these things can be proteins. These things can be proteins that have a lipid molecule joined to them, or a protein that has a sugar molecule joined to them, or they could even be just sugar molecules. Okay, so these are all little components that are added to the cell membrane. So really a more sophisticated and real world understanding of a cell membrane, right? The model that we use to describe that is the fluid mosaic model. Because the phospholipid bilayer is very fluid. It's like oil that you have maybe in your sink after you've washed some dishes or something, and it just kind of floats there. And if you disturb the surface of water, that oil just kind of undulates with the water, doesn't do anything else, right? Doesn't crack or anything. Okay. And then the mosaic part is just all of these other things that are added to the cell membrane. So here I see a glycolipid. A glycolipid is part sugar and part lipid. A glycoprotein is part sugar and part protein, right? All right, and here is just a protein, and some are just proteins. Some of the things that are just proteins can be a channel, right? So it could be a passageway for things that can't get through the cell membrane. What's something that can't get through the cell membrane that you're aware of? Sodium, that's right, sodium ion can't. So a cell might make a channel so sodium can enter or leave based on the concentration gradient, right? But the cell might like to be able to regulate when the sodium enters or leaves, so that channel might have what we call a gate on it. It might be a gated channel, and then the cell controls when that gate is open and when it's closed. So proteins can be a channel, it could be a gated channel, right? These proteins could be something like what I mentioned on one of the previous slides in Chapter 6. It could be an enzyme, right? So there could be enzymes within the cell membrane. And also, the shape of these molecules is very specific, right? And the shape of these sugar molecules that I see all over the place could be antigens. And an antigen is just a marker that tells this cell that it belongs to a group of other cells with the same kind of antigen by structure. It has the same kind of shape, right? So all the cells in your body, of course, belong to you, and they have antigens with all the same shape, so that every cell in your body knows that all the other cells belong to you. So that if a cell that has a different shaped antigen enters your body, guess what all the cells in your body knows? Doesn't belong there, right? And what is your immune system going to do with that cell that doesn't belong there? It's going to try to kill it, right? Based on the antigen nature of that cell, which is what? Just the shape of the sugar molecules on the cell membrane. So cell membranes have antigens, have channels, have enzymes. Oh, and also we looked at another thing that has a certain site right here that can bind a signaling compound. What did we call that? That's a receptor, right? So receptor proteins are also put in the cell membrane so that it can receive signals from the extracellular fluid. Okay. And other kinds of proteins are in the cell membrane that give structure to the cell, right? And microtubules can push and pull on these proteins that are embedded in the membrane, and so the cell can have a certain kind of shape depending on how the microtubules push and pull on the cell membrane. Are you aware of any kind of specialized shapes that cells can have?
No.
Round. Okay. Yeah, round and flat. What do we call a round and flat cell? That's an anatomy. That's a squamous cell, right? Because it's flat. What's another kind?
Cuboidal,
if it's square. Okay, or cube-like, and what's another classic form? Columnar, right? Yeah, so those proteins in the membrane help form the shape of the cell. And then there's one that we didn't talk about very much in anatomy, and it's a shapeshifter, right? It can change shape and can crawl around in your body, can crawl between cells in a membrane, things like that. And a good example of that would be a monocyte. It's a kind of white blood cell, and it turns into a macrophage when that blood cell leaves the blood. All right, so these proteins are pretty important because when the structure of the membrane changes, because we change these compounds in the cell membrane, what happens to that cell? The function changes as well. When we change the shape of the cell membrane, the function of that cell changes. Okay. Surface markers, those are the antigens that I talked about. Okay, oh, here's that shapeshifter. And we talked about this process already. Here is a monocyte, and let's just say this is a bacteria, and I can even see some antigens on the surface of this bacteria, and hence this monocyte knows that this thing doesn't belong inside the body because it has the wrong antigen, so it's going to surround this particle right here, and then the cell membrane is going to completely surround it, and it's going to end up in a vesicle inside the cell. And since it's a particle that has entered the cell, we call that phagocytosis. Phagocytosis is active transport. Okay. And it's a form of endocytosis. Does anybody know another form of endocytosis? Ah, Yeah, pinocytosis. If what's being taken inside the cell is not a particle but a fluid, right, that's what we call pinocytosis. Okay. Good. We'll start around here next time on Tuesday. Don't forget the sign-in sheet, and let me turn some lights on before you leave, because sometimes these stairs are tricky. Okay, sign-in sheet, please.